Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And we are talking about Season 1, Episode 10, titled Marco. It's the season finale.
Yeah, it is.
At the end of this thing, I want to talk about what we thought about the season as a whole.
And I've got the email organized thusly.
Perfect. Because I don't think we're going to do a wrap-up cast on this.
I don't think so either.
Our schedule is such that it doesn't make sense, and I don't know how much I really have to say about it.
I feel like that we did get, I think a lot of people were anticipating, because weren't we kind of flip-flopping on that last week?
Yeah.
Because there's some people sent in deliberate, like, season wrap-up thoughts. And I feel like we covered most of the ground.
Sure.
So, yeah. And it's also weird that this is kind of, I don't know what you thought about the episode, but this is following kind of the Wire / the Game of Thrones pattern that the penultimate episode is the Hammer.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm not saying that this isn't a good episode.
By comparison, it was uneventful.
It's more of a epilogue and a bridge to next season than it was a climax.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I felt that going into like the final scene, I guess, where he pulls into the parking lot. I was like, man, this doesn't feel like much of a finale to me. I like the note they went out on, though.
I was surprised. I feel like that they might have painted themselves into a bit of a corner there. And I'm wondering if they're going to, if they think about walking that back next season.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to see how Jimmy pivots his stance here. I mean, it's I can't remember who said it, but it's like he drove into Mike's troll booth, Jimmy, and he left Saul.
Yeah, definitely.
And if that's true, then it is going to be interesting how he works with, you know, Kim and his brother and the upgraded to washed asshole status Hamlin. How those guys still
remain
the part of their
least,
life.
At the very least, yeah, he's washed now. I want to talk about him later on in significant scenes.
But yeah, it's going to be kind of hard for them to stay in his sphere of influence or his world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking we're beautifully set up for him to be kind of running a high scale. A lot of things surprised me, yeah. Like,
yeah.
I thought Nacho was going to pop up and ruin the thing at the last scene. Him just deciding on his own was an interesting choice.
Sure, we'll talk about it more when we
just
get there.
Just broadly speaking, did you like the finale? Because I liked it a lot more than it looks like a lot of people on Facebook and the forums did. A lot of people were throwing around words like disappointing, letdown, which, again, I understand since 109, I think, is an inarguably a better, more emotionally resonant episode.
Absolutely, 100%.
But I thought this was still a good episode.
It is a good episode. It's definitely not a bad episode. And as far as episodes of TV go, I still prefer watching this over most other things on TV right now.
Okay.
That's
not a very high bar for you. Because essentially the stuff we don't cover is the bar, or the stuff we cover is your kind of like TV watching and everything else.
Yeah, but you know me, I'm
you're Anthony Bourdaining it.
I'm in it for the entertainment too. So it's like there's stuff like Mad Men on right now, which I love, but it's not nearly as entertaining.
Oh,
as
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Better Call Saul. But as far as like comparing this to last episode, yeah, I think this was less of an episode than last episode was.
Mm-hmm.
You threw all your punches and you're kind of winded in this last episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm not to say I'm down on it. I think it was good, but
yeah,
not as good. Anyway, why don't you tell us who made this one?
Written and directed by Peter Gould.
Then
you have to look it up.
Yeah.
The ghoul himself. Which I think it was a conversation I had with Shane where he kind of chided us for maybe putting too much emphasis. I porky pigged it.
All right.
Reconjugated that fucking verb. The Villigan's role, because of our affection for him in Breaking Bad, that you know, him and Gould are kind of like co-creators, and maybe even Gould is in the driver's seat. You know, he
on
got
Breaking Bad or this?
No.
Okay.
On Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And that I think it's telling that like a lot of the showrunner interviews going around the internet are of the Gould himself. So
I mean, I've talked about in the past how Vince Gillian had said that he was going to step aside after season one.
Yeah, but I think
and completely leave it to him.
I think by branding it the Villa Gang, it kind of somehow shorts. I don't know. It's like,
well, he is the ringleader for Breaking Bad, and I get that that's changing a little bit here.
Sure,
as it transitions away from him, but I don't know. In my mind, certainly Peter Gould is a big part of this.
Oh, yeah. And I just don't.
Maybe I
wouldn't
want to
disrespect
the
man because he's awesome.
Yeah.
And plus, there's not a really good equivalent ghoul gang. I mean, the Villa gang just sounds right.
Sure, I'm with you. Okay. Let's start with the recap. Yeah.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. Marco is sitting in a bar, and we know him from the first episode.
He's Butthole Man.
He is a Butthole Man. Yeah. He's Smoke on the Water Man.
Mm-hmm.
He does a bar trick and wins $20, which I don't even know if that works or if that's just an effect.
I suspect it works. I would like to try it. It seemed like it was a similar principle to the, jerking a... Well, I got to watch where I go here.
The tablecloth.
Jerking a tablecloth out from underneath a set table.
Yeah.
Like, if it's all about how you snap it to overcome that surface friction.
Right, maybe we'll try it on a lunch with Jim and Aaron here.
But, that's a good idea.
Beers.
That's a good idea. Hell, I got a beer bottle right there. You got a coin. I probably have $20 in my pocket.
Jimmy comes in. He tells Marco, hey, I'm moving to Albuquerque. And Marco thinks it's in Mexico for some reason. and he's going to go work in the mailroom at Chuck's Law Firm. And Marco is not pleased with that, tries to convince him to have one last scam fling before he leaves.
I was intrigued by the tar money scam.
Tar money?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of scams and a scamtage that I thought about looking up and getting into detail, and I thought, that might not be that interesting. But there was the one in particular, and that's where they've got a case full of money that might have been smoke damaged or something, and Jimmy wipes it, and it's like black paper, and it comes clean and looks like a $20 bill.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that is the tar money scam, but I'm trying to think how that all works. I don't know.
Well, I think what I got from that little montage is that the chemical is something that they don't have much of. Like, they just have this tiny bit of it.
Yeah.
So he wipes off the bills. The other bills are obviously not $100 bills. They're ones or fakes or whatever.
Right.
The pieces of paper, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then they sell this whole box of money to the guy for, $1,000 or whatever and say, go get the chemical to clean it all off.
It's the thing about scams of that type is it always feels like, I guess the Kennedy one's a pretty good example. It takes advantage of, you have to be kind of stupid and very greedy.
You do. You have to be an opportunist. Certainly.
For a scam to work on you, which, a lot of people wrote in like, saying that Marco's a scumbag, this or that.
They're both kind of scumbags.
Sure.
They're lying to people, scamming them out of money.
I get it, but there's a difference between taking advantage of someone at a bar who's kind of maybe a douchebag and an opportunist himself, and you're kind of out hustling them, versus like people that cold call elderly people and try to sign them up for services and dazzle them and confuse them, or taking advantage of young people. I mean, there's scams and then there's scams. I don't know. Maybe I'm incorrect to see some moral flexibility here, but.
Yeah, they're not nice guys.
All that conversation just to say tar money scam, WTF. I don't.
Okay. Another WTF in this scene. How does he not get the Miles Davis reference?
He does seem unusually.
Like, what are you talking about? Miles Davis gives up the trumpet. I don't get it.
Do you think that his brother is responsible for his being kind of well watched and well read? Like he lived with Chuck out there, and Chuck is an old time movie buff. Although Marco,
it wasn't even that. It's just like everybody knows who Miles Davis is, right?
I guess. Yeah, you'd think so.
Like everybody knows who he is.
The thing is, I guess Jimmy was really distracted too. I mean, he did not want to come in there and say goodbye to his friend, and he was forced to. And he clearly felt, the peer pressure of wanting to stay there and pull off one last time.
And you can hear Chuck honking in the background, and it's
He's
definitely being rushed out that door.
Yeah, so maybe that, because I thought that's too. He's like, for a guy to drop so many pop culture references to not get Miles Davis.
Yeah. Anyway, we get the intro here, which is Saul's coffee cup falling to the ground in his office and breaking. And that is Saul Goodman's coffee cup, not Jimmy's.
Yeah, and one thing I snagged, we kind of talked about this last week, and I saw it confirmed in an interview with the Gould and Gilligan, is that they had more or less just had a random collection of just intro stuff, but they selected the last two to fit the theme. Jimmy being pissed on and World's Greatest Lawyer getting shattered, the thematically appropriate, which I honestly wouldn't mind seeing them extend that to the next season. You know, because that adds, I mean, for a podcaster. I almost felt
like they should have, like, inflated the Statue of Liberty on this one or something. Like, this is the creation of Saul Goodman, well, as far as I can tell.
That's the other thing. In some of these interviews, I feel like Gould has backed off a little bit about, like, I don't think he's in Saul just yet.
Yeah.
Which means, I think, because that's certainly the takeaway I got. I think mm-hmm. that there will be a little bit of crab fishing, crab walking away from the right. conclusion here.
Maybe so. Anyway, Jimmy's waiting in the lobby of HHM in present day. All that other stuff happened in 92.
I guess. Was it that far back? It's 2002 is present.
Yeah.
92?
I think it was 10 years.
Yeah, you're right.
Because he says it's been 10 years or whatever when he comes back in 2002. Yeah.
Sure.
So it's been a whole decade. Anyway, Jimmy in present day is sitting in the lobby of HHM when Kim sees him and she comes down there and
speaking
sits
next of to him. Radioactive George O'Keefe hellscapes. Uh-huh. What do you think of that glowing wall they're sitting in front of?
Glowing wall.
You didn't notice it?
No.
Oh yeah. It's like where they're having that conversation. There's like a panel that covers the stairwell and it's like an opaque glass that they've lit with an orange light. And it just is like, they're sitting in front of a fusion reaction. Maybe it's just my television, but it's extremely distracting on the two watches I gave it.
Yeah, my TV's probably so dark I didn't even notice it.
It's like you're wearing sunglasses on this stuff.
Yeah. The other thing I did notice in this episode, now that you bring up color, is there's a lot of red around Jimmy and around Margo.
Starting this shit up again, are
you? You have to. When the pedigree of the show demands it, I think. I don't know what it means. I'm sure there will be people out there speculating.
All I know is when they have a wardrobe analysis of this season, there's going to be a 4 or 5 episode of just complete white for the Matlock era.
Sure. And then there's the horrible paisley or whatever shirt he's got on.
Then he's got the black. I thought his funeral outfit was tight.
Just, you know, yes, very, that's how very he elegant. Should be dressing as a lawyer.
Yeah, or a man in black.
Uh-huh. Anyway, Kim comes down to sit next to him and he tells her that he's there to take the deal because he found out about Chuck not wanting him there. And then she kind of asks him, he asks her why she didn't say anything. And she's like, I didn't want you hating your brother, that sort of thing. So, you know, I mean, as much as a stink as you put up about it last episode, that is in fact the reason. And we guessed that.
No, I mean, like I said, I didn't kind of knew that. I didn't want to pillory her. I just thought it's like it's not the choice I would make, but I respect that is a choice that people do make.
Yeah, Jimmy doesn't seem too bothered by it, I guess.
Might not be a surprise to people that, you know, since a sizable portion of my family disowned me over religious reasons, that I don't put a lot of stock in blood thicker than water or preserving family ties.
Yeah.
When there's been massive betrayal involved, I'm like, no, fuck all that.
Yeah.
Fuck Chuck in particular, so...
Sure, we have a little bit of interesting perspective on this one. A little
bit of heat on my take there.
Yeah. Then Jimmy goes up to Hamlin's office. He gives him the case.
Yeah.
He says, okay, this is yours. And he also gives him a long list of Chuck's daily needs.
Yes.
Which Hamlin is surprised by.
Yep.
And Jimmy gets some money, $20,000 that he was promised.
Yep.
Which is a nice little windfall for him.
Not bad. It exceeds the illegitimate bribe he got, right? Because that was only 50, or was that 20?
I thought it was 40.
Was it 40? Was the
bribe, yeah.
Holy shit.
It's a big bribe.
No, I think it's 20 because he had 15 left, I thought. Or maybe... Anyway. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure it was 40.
Okay.
Anyway, I like here that he apologizes for calling him a pig fucker. He kind of realized the same thing that we realized along the way.
Yeah,
Hamlin is not necessarily such a bad guy. Like I'm still trying to figure him out. How bad is Hamlin?
Same here. He could just be one of those guys who seems like a douchebag in just his mannerism, but when you get to know him, he's actually not. I mean, I've worked with a couple folks. IT folks tend to be kind of just abrasive, and maybe like lawyers, abrasive and contentious by nature. But every once in a while, you'll get a guy who seems like just a giant asshole, and then you talk to him, and they're just like, that's their personality.
Yeah.
But they actually have no malice, whereas you also have the passive-aggressive type that seem like they're nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Hamlin and Chuck, right? Chuck is a guy who looks like a douchebag, seems like he's got a soul. Chuck is a guy who seems like he's a caring, kind, patient person that's masking kind of an asshole. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The Charlie Hustle thing is what really, because like I don't see how anyone can see that as anything but demeaning,
yeah.
especially mm-hmm. with Jimmy's background.
Sure.
That presumably Hamlin knows. Like if mm-hmm. if he wasn't a con man at one time, then Charlie Hustle, you know, might be talking about your grit and all that. But I, you know, it's like it's Pete Rose's nickname, the disgraced baseball player who can never get in the Hall of Fame because he mm-hmm. bet on baseball games. And I just it's hard to walk that one back for me.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But he could just be oblivious.
He's also like, I feel that his comments are somewhat genuine, too. I think Hamlin, when he sees this long list of the things that he's been doing for Chuck every day, he knows the history of Jimmy going out and getting his law degree just by hustling and working nights
that
and
part's,
weekends.
I totally agree.
Slaves away
you.
In the mailroom. I think he's earning some respect from Hamlin here.
That moment where he realized all that he's been doing for his brother and yeah. the depths of his brother's kind of betrayal. I thought that was genuine and well played. And honestly, this Hamlin's been well played by this guy.
Definitely.
Because he hasn't changed his performance. Mm-hmm. It's just the context that we see it in. And that's kind of, I mean, hats off to Villigan and Gould and the actor portraying him, I forget his name. That's pretty good.
I know stuff. That I know that Kim pulls some of the strings to get him this job in El Paso. But I wonder also how much Hamlin was impressed by Jimmy and decided that, yeah, it's a good idea. I wonder how many strings she really had to pull.
That's the thing, like,
to change his mind.
Sure. And that's the thing. How many strings did Kim have to pull? I mean, Hamlin at some
I think
point
it's less.
Has to buy into this. And,
yeah.
you know, it's knowing that Kim was saying that, like, you know, this is something your brother can't get involved in, which
yeah.
is fair enough. Although I wonder, I mean, that would be the ultimate if Chuck actually called and be like, hey, you know, my brother... And because I think he could.
There's
Chuck
also,
seems like he has enough respect in the legal community that he could call the partners up there and be like, you're making a big
you
mistake.
You might be right.
Have you ever heard of a Chicago sunroof?
I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter, right? He's not taking this job. So,
yeah,
I guess this is all for nothing. But I think you're right about mm-hmm. Chuck maybe being a little bitter. The other thing is questioning once again how good of a guy Hamlin actually is. I wonder if he could use this list and this long procedure for Chuck to bring Chuck down somehow, have him committed, do something if he's actually a bad guy. At this point, I'm leaning toward no.
Uh-huh.
I'm leaning toward I don't think Hamlin would do any of that.
Right.
But I suppose it's possible.
It really does make Jimmy, when you rethink the entire series, look very delusional. That he was
sure.
going in there, you are messing with the fundamental force. And this was all Chuck calling the plays 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So Jimmy was going to bat for a person and taking care of somebody. It's crazy.
So we go to the parking garage, and Jimmy is apologizing to Kim for yelling at her. And she asks if he's okay with all this stuff with Chuck and his brother. And he's like, yeah, there's nothing I can do to change his feelings. So whatever. You can tell it's eating at him, though.
Yeah. And I thought that it's really interesting how we haven't talked about this since the first two episodes, but the dented trash can.
Yeah.
How they use that very similarly to the dented hand towel rack for Breaking Bad. That it was kind of a touchstone of how we felt about something and now how we feel about something. Like, you know, Walt's cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
Now Jimmy's, you know, that it's just kind of the constant reminder of all of his failure and delusions. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting how it was always kind of in the foreground in a lot of these scenes.
Yep. Then we go over to the bingo hall and Jimmy is hosting bingo. There are a string of bees that come up, which caused Jimmy to start thinking about his brother, and it just breaks him.
This performance, I thought, was something out of a Jim Carrey comedy.
It's incredible.
The constant bees. And at the one point where he announces, if we have another bee,
we might have a problem.
We might have a problem here. It's like, this is a man on the edge.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious, but by the time he got finished telling the Chicago sunroof story,
oh God,
I thought it was like, man... This guy, I guess he was running petty scams and stuff, but he seemed like he was happy. And I also uh-huh. still feel like that Jimmy is like a good dude underneath all this stuff. But this kind of, it shackled him emotionally to this parasite, Chuck.
Yes, and that is, I feel, a key to why he becomes the person he becomes at the end of this episode.
And it's not like it's, I mean, yes, he did shit in this guy's car, and there were children involved.
He did some bad things.
But what he said about how he got railroaded, I mean, yeah. You know, everyone's heard of a time where it's like, you can, you're drunk, and you pee outside of a bar, and oh,
one little Chicago sunroof.
It's 100 yards away from a park. It's at 3 o'clock in the morning, but now you're a sex offender because you took your dick out within 100 yards of a park. I mean,
it's
that's why I guess I'm saying, when, you know, I had this conversation with the lawyers about the law being scary.
Yes.
It is terrifying because it can fucking change your life in a heartbeat with you being kind of ignorant. Now, I guess the moral is don't piss in public and don't shit in a sunroof, which I generally subscribe to.
Sure. But never done either of those.
I don't know. Society's got to figure out a way to make punishments fit the crime. Like, you shouldn't have your life ruined by that kind of mistake.
Intention is a tough thing, though, right?
Yeah. But I'm just saying
after
that,
the fact, they can say, well, I didn't mean to show my asshole to these kids.
I get it. But, like, again, should you be labeled a sex offender for the rest of your life because of that? Like,
sure.
That's fundamentally different than whipping a gun out and shooting someone.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
You don't get labeled a sex offender for that. You get labeled a murderer.
You know, it depends how creative you are with the weapon.
I guess so. I don't want to talk too much about just the things we think are funny or things like that. But I have to say, I think maybe one of the funniest lines in this episode, if not the season, mm-hmm. is the way that he leads from, how was I to know that there were kids in the back? I maintain that tent was illegal. Yes. That tent line just cracks me up every time.
Sure. Yeah. It's like the minutia of stuff that is why you in particular think something is unjust or just.
And the picture he's painting here is just glorious.
And, like, again, I had a few. Like, he's got all these excuses and just keeps on building and building and building.
And the way he describes it as just, you know, just a simple Chicago sunroof.
Right.
As if that's an everyday occurrence in Chicago.
And also the details of Chet and what a douchebag, as if that the bottom line is it just that someone's going to get their life ruined if you shit in a car? It's like, I'd probably say no, but, you know, all the other stuff is just details.
I doubt it, too.
I'd like to get Chet's side of the story. You know, that's I guess that's what I keep thinking, is like, how much of this is Jimmy completely exaggerating? Mm-hmm. But Jimmy feels like he's a good dude. Like, he would never do anything more than what he thought would be a harmless prank. I mean, it would probably do several thousand dollars of damage to a white upholstery, but...
The other thing that has me thinking about is in Breaking Bad, where the BMW pulls up to the gas station, and it's, you know, the guy who's been talking on his phone in the bank, and Walt goes and blows up his car.
Right.
What if he had just given him a Chicago sunroof there?
There you go. And the other thing that made this work as a comedy is the audience.
Oh, yes. Yeah, those old people.
These old folks in their bingo and just sitting there, and
they're mortified.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, just his whole performance as a man on the edge and the little things he does when the bees kept coming. Just so good. So good.
The one thing I really think they missed that would have capped this scene off very nicely is when he tosses that bingo ball to the guy and he drops the mic and he walks out in frustration. The guy should have yelled bingo at the very end of the scene.
Like, let a beat, and then, like,
bingo!
Yeah, that would have been the missed opportunity. That's a missed opportunity.
Just caps the whole scene off, but okay.
And then the whole still no winners, I thought that was kind of an interesting meta. Like, the thing, you know, life just keeps giving Jimmy bees. And he, at each turn, is like, have I arrived yet? Have I won? Have I got something out of this?
Nope. Sure didn't.
Nothing but melanoma the size of a pineapple.
And it gives us a little more insight into exactly, you know, how he got in the precarious situation he's in with Chuck. You know, Chuck came in and bailed him out. We didn't know how he became a sex offender or how he was being charged with those things. That's it. Basically, there was a guy who was connected in the mob and leaned on some law enforcement agents to push this case farther.
I didn't know it was mob. I took it more as a Chicago political machine, which... could broadly be speaking,
maybe
mob
the Cicero thing, like Cicero connected to me says mob due to like the Capone stuff and all that. But
sure.
But I'm You might be right.
I think that's all the words, but now it's like, I think Chicago politics are just crooked because they're crooked. There's no
potential
mob behind it. But then again, yeah. I could be naive there.
All right. Jimmy goes back to Chicago, Cicero? It's hard to tell.
I'm pretty sure it's Cicero. Everyone says it's Cicero. I think it's always been talked about,
Cicero. Ferris Bueller stuff confuses me because he spends a day in Chicago.
Sure.
So maybe, you know, Jimmy just told Kim, hey, I'm going to Chicago, and, you know, he's actually going to Cicero because she might not know where Cicero is.
When I go back home, I don't say I'm going to visit Greenwood or Greenfield or Greensburg or all the fucking green shit that we got in Indiana. I say I'm going to Indianapolis because no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
No one gives a shit. If I said that, I would tell you, but like, sure. You know, if I was just talking to some random dude, so.
Yep. So he reunites with Marco in this same bar here, and they catch up. And then Jimmy decides that they should pull a scam on some guy who walks in, and they go to work on the half-dollar scam. And I'm not going to describe that whole scene.
Right.
It's just, you know, the half-dollar scam.
One thing I want to ask you, because I know you, this seems to be kind of one of your bugaboos. Did you feel like the lotto or the bingo scene went on too long?
The bingo scene? No.
I thought it was paced perfectly. Just when I started to think it was getting tedious, he would do something new with his performance that I thought funny, or he would add a twist to the story. It's just like, you know.
And it was providing a lot of insight into what he's thinking and also his history and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like asking if, you know, that's the sequence in Raiders of the Lost Ark from the time they find the Ark to the time it gets loaded on submarine. Did that go on too long? I mean, I don't think so, because he got drugged behind a truck and he took out a bunch of Nazis and he punched a guy and the guy got chopped up by it's one big scene, but shit just keeps piling on top of each other to makes it entertaining.
I mean,
whereas like some of the stuff in the
desert specifically,
what felt like just eating a big tub of vanilla ice cream, and it's like, okay, enough already.
It was the same joke a few times, and it wasn't informing us anything about Saul until we get to the part where he talks Tuco out of killing those guys, certainly.
What did you think about the scam scene, the Kennedy scam scene? Did that go on too long?
Oh, the montage?
No, not the montage. That's the third half dollar.
Okay.
The half dollar one.
I felt like I enjoyed seeing how their scams work.
Yeah, because we never...
It's a side of I don't get to see scamming very often.
It's like Matchstick Men. You know, there's a lot of pleasure in just seeing them run the scams.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I thought it was useful because Marco seemed more like a sycophant, which he is.
Yeah.
But I never got that he had real skill in this. But, I mean, from what I can see, he's kind of up there with Jimmy.
He's not just the butthole guy. Yeah,
he's not just the butthole guy. He's not as slick, and there's certain roles. Like, you know, he's never going to talk anyone to thinking that he's
Kevin Costner.
Maybe he could go with the John Candy before he died. But
could go with the private Wilford eye from Big Lebowski, certainly.
Mm, John Goodman?
No, the private eye, the guy who's looking for the Knudsens.
Oh, yes.
I don't remember his name.
Sure, yeah.
Shit,
Not quite as good as Kevin Costner. Stick with John Goodman.
Yeah.
Or Wilford Brimley.
Definitely. There's a lot of stuff in here that I don't know that we need to talk about. It's just them getting this guy to buy the half dollar.
Sure.
And then they go on the scamming spree. You know, you got a little taste of it, and he's back in the life for a brief period, for about a week. Anything you want to talk about in the scamming spree?
No, there's a bunch of them that I started to research some, and you know, everyone knows about the Nigerian prince scheme, right?
Sure, but in 92, you got to think maybe that might have worked.
Well, someone on, I think, Facebook or the forums were suggesting maybe he invented the Nigerian scheme, because I think that was a scheme and then it got new life through email, because it's essentially a way to just farm marks all day long without even trying.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting. I don't. And you know, the Stradivarius scheme seemed like it's pretty much a just different type of the Rolex / Kennedy's dollar scheme. But there's a lot of things like the dirty money. I wasn't sure how that all worked. The, hey, buddy, can you help me get my wife's car out of a bad neighborhood? I mean, the blind man asking you if you've – I mean, that's like, I think, just a joke. Like, could you tell me today's winning number, sir?
Yeah.
And see, I like – that's an interesting scam, because if you fall for it, you are by definition an asshole.
Which scam?
A blind person coming up to you with a lottery ticket and a copy of today's paper and asking, "What can you tell me what today's winning numbers are?" If you're essentially scamming a person that you think is blind and helpless.
I'm struggling
out of their winning ticket.
You're right. You're definitely so right
like,
about
I
that.
I feel like a scam like that is almost victimless because.
Well, I'm also struggling to see how he makes any money off of that. Like, if someone tells him, no, that's not, what is, he's not going to sell him a piece of paper.
There's got,
piece of paper.
Yeah. Well, I think.
It has to, like, match a certain number of them.
Yeah.
But how would the blind guy even know? Like, that's the thing. He could just say, no, it matches zero of the numbers. And then, here, let me throw that away for you or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And how does he actually make money on that?
Yeah.
I guess we're not supposed to know. Maybe Marco comes in and says, hey, you're ripping that guy off. And then it's like, we're going to take you to the cops. And it's like, okay, it's like maybe we can work something that make everybody happy.
Yep.
I bet that's the punchline of that.
I could see that.
But the help me get my wife's car out of a bad neighborhood. Like, what the? That's the one I wish I got a little bit more of.
Sure.
Anyway.
So Jimmy wakes up the next morning to a half naked woman accusing him of not being Kevin Costner.
And thank God, because I was starting to feel like an unwashed asshole for this Kevin Costner business.
Should we finally explain that?
Yes. I thought we did.
On the podcast?
Oh, we never did on the
podcast. We did on the forums, yeah.
So people have been steadily emailing, and some people figured it out, especially on the forums and Facebook. But people have been emailing us like, love your podcast, but what the fuck is going on with your theme, man?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It's different every time. It doesn't match the tone.
Doesn't match. Like, I thought you were maybe going for, like, a particular feel on something, but what the hell? Mm-hmm. What is in common with every one of these intro pieces of music?
Kevin Costner.
They're all Kevin Costner vehicles.
Kevin Costner is in common with all of them, and that was just
and we kind of went in chronological order of his career too.
We did. We got a bunch of those in there. Bull Durham and Untouchables, Wyatt Earp and Waterworld, all those.
And some of them are super obscure.
The Bodyguard is not super
honestly
obscure.
I thought everybody would get it the week of The Bodyguard, and that seems to be the light bulb moment, but surprisingly We played this joke out for a long time with a lot of people not getting it or not caring to say that they got it.
And I think this episode really made it pay off for me. Like,
yes.
If they didn't do the Kevin Costner thing in this episode, I kind of started feeling like, oh, that was a big mistake.
We'll never do that again.
Because it's a one-off thing in Breaking Bad,
so
like season, the middle of the run.
We were questioning ourselves.
Yeah.
But when that played on my couch, I was like, yes!
Vindication.
Yes, yes.
So good.
I was Walt punching my steering wheel after I blew up Tuco's lab.
So her and her friend get dressed and leave, and then Jimmy's checking his messages on the phone, and he has a whole bunch from his elderly clients. Marco wakes up. He wants to go scam one more time. Jimmy explains to him, I'm a lawyer. I got to get back to my clients, all this stuff. Marco convinces him to pull one last scam with the Rolex.
Mm-hmm.
One scam too many.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of cool things about, you know, oh, you're a lawyer, you must be king of the desert, riding around in a white caddy.
Yep.
But
we know he eventually does.
The desperation of Marco kind of got to me here.
Yes.
Like, this guy is about to have is one step away from having a complete nervous breakdown about how pathetic his life is.
Yeah, I don't need the money. I need this.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out if this was him, you know, being a pathetic guy who needs to go scamming, otherwise he doesn't feel good about himself, or if he realizes that he might not have much time left. If he's thinking, oh man, maybe he's had a heart attack before.
That could be, but I took it as, you know, because when we find him, it's in the middle of the day. He's working for his brother-in-law's company, standpiping, whatever.
He's passed out on
the
bar.
He's passed out drunk on a bar stool. That is a very unhappy person. It's essentially, wasn't that what Jimmy said? Like, this stuff is all right for beer money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy has spent the last 10 years contenting himself with, can I scam tonight's drinks?
Yeah.
And if I can, then that's a successful night. That's a pretty hollow existence. When Jimmy comes in,
say so.
It's like High Rollerville and everything feels... I mean, it must be a rush to be a con man. Like, it's all the highs and lows of being a salesman with the element of criminality and danger. And, like, you might get your ass kicked.
Yeah, more adrenaline.
And you've got no recourse. So, yeah, I could see it being very addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy is kind of like the better looking, more successful version of Marco. Yeah. And maybe he's even Marco's, you know, like the white feather for Dumbo. Like Marco okay. is capable of great things, but only when Jimmy's around.
Yeah. Now he's pulling $20 beer bottle yeah. scams. It's yeah. like when he was getting, you know, $1,000 a night for the Rolex.
No, it's like, you know, Laurel and Hardy, you know, Jimmy can kind of run his own set because he's a little bit more sophisticated. He's a little bit more charming. He can pass more as a non-schlub, whereas this guy is the kind of, you know, setup guy. You know, he looks
this
like
guy a, looks like a scammer coming to get you.
Yeah. yeah, yeah, yeah. But he makes the thing like the, you know, the Kennedy half dollar work.
Yes.
Because you would totally buy him as being like, oh, I know a guy who's got a pawn shop and I can blah, blah, blah. And it, yeah, yeah. I think they're a good 1-2 punch combo.
Yep, I'm with you. We go to the Rolex scam where Marco has a real heart attack and he dies. Not much more to say about that. I did notice something this time that I didn't notice the first time around when they pulled this. The howling is actually the signal that, hey, we're yes. coming, get ready.
Yes.
I thought that was cool to go back and show the same prank but a different perspective on it.
No, honestly, I thought this the strength of this episode was it made a lot of the stuff that maybe we thought was weak and maybe still is. Like, I don't know that you can justify a lot of the stuff in the first two episodes. You know, and I feel like people that are really defending that and saying how great it was, they were more banking on the promise that it did live up to.
Yeah.
But there was some weaknesses. But seeing this and, like, you know, that time where he sat down to two redhead twins and told them about the legend of Slipping Jimmy. Mm-hmm. The fact that they've had that theme that steadily built up into this episode, I felt like was satisfying to me.
Me too.
And if you didn't, I guess, see this as a payoff, an ultimate payoff of some of that slower stuff, then you could be unhappy. But honestly, I thought it redeemed a lot of that material. I mean, like I said, the Tuco stuff from the beginning, I think, is going to be borderline unwatchable when you go back through it.
Yeah.
Because what little charm it has essentially is, isn't it cool to see this character from Breaking Bad? Isn't it cool to see Raymond Cruz chewing the scenery again? All that kind of stuff.
I'm with you. That's going to be less enjoyable to watch than the rest of this season.
It's like Norman Reedus came on to Saturday Night Live for a 30-second cameo and killed it. I do not want to watch that skit 5 times in a way that I could watch the pilot episode of Breaking Bad, you know, probably once a month for the rest of my life. And, well, that might be extreme, but you know what I'm saying? Certainly, yeah, it's much more rewatchable because it doesn't hinge on a bunch of, you know, hey, 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 do you see that guy? He's Tuco.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Speaking of rewatchability.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller is one of my favorite movies.
Really?
Yeah. Bueller's Day Off. There's a line in here where Marco has the heart attack. Jimmy calls up the police, the emergency line, and says, hey, I'm in an alley by LaSalle and Shermer. Mm-hmm. Shermer is apparently one of the cities that John Hughes likes to use a whole lot in his movies as, you know, the hometowns of the heroes of his movies.
Yeah.
There are some other connections, like Shermer. The Shermer High School is the high school in Breakfast Club. Mm-hmm. And the high school that the town he grew up in is actually on Shermer Street. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Shermer references. And when he calls that out in the scene, that is a direct reference to John Hughes, as is the Ferris Bueller stuff, where Kim calls him in the next scene. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of cool.
I think, you know, I was just looking on a map. I assumed that Cicero was a suburb of Chicago.
It's pretty far away.
Is it? Because I'm seeing that it looks like Cicero is like a literally neighborhood of Chicago.
Well, Chicago's fucking huge.
Sure.
Chicago is spread way out. I don't know. Uh-huh. It's hard to say what is and isn't in Chicago.
Right, no.
For me, anyway.
Yeah, Cicero is, I guess it's, you know, it's like a 20-minute car ride, but it seems like it's inside what I would consider the loop of Chicago. Not downtown Chicago, but
okay. It's
even more connected to Chicago than I thought.
All right. Jimmy goes to Marco's funeral, and he gets a call. I mean, there's not a whole lot to talk about before this call. Just one of his buddies, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. A guy he must have known tangentially through Marco, standing out there, and he bums a cigarette off of him. And then Kim calls up and says, hey, this Sandpiper case is too big for HHM. We're taking it. we're going to share it with the firm in Santa Fe, and they've got a job to offer you in their partner track, which I guess would eventually lead to a partnership.
Sure.
And, you know, he thanks her for that opportunity. And
do you think she was... So, you know, a lot of this is meta, but we had a lawyer write in saying that how unimaginably vast the scale of HH&M is, especially for a market like Albuquerque. Do you think that it was literally too big for HH&M, or is this a way to make an offer to Jimmy without... Well, I mean, I don't think Hamlin likes Jimmy enough to split a case with another law firm just to get the job.
You're probably right about that.
So I think that meta of how huge it is, we kind of have to take that with a, you know, that was more for the ovation of Chuck and less for look how immense and world conquering HH&M is.
I think you're right.
All right. Yeah.
Then Chuck criticizes. Oh, yeah.
We got a, you didn't mention the pinky ring, right?
No, I did not.
So it's a nice little moment because it's something we definitely see Saul continues on in the Breaking Bad era. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of cool to see the origin story. Did you see Steppenwolf's review where he makes an analogy to like Gollum and the One Ring? That this is literally, you know, we've seen a battle for... Steppenwolf got really poetic in this week's episode. He said that this is a story of a bad man that is trying to be good and the universe just refuses to accept it. Like, nope, not buying any of this shit. You must be a bad guy. But he also said that this ring could represent that it's the warring sides of Jimmy. You know, Chuck and the law is sacred and Kim and Hamlin on one side and then Marco and Nacho and kind of Mike on the other.
And kind of himself too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, who is he as a blank slate, and putting on that ring symbolizes him giving himself over to the power of the butthole.
I think you're right.
No, that's Steppenwolf. Steppenwolf, right.
All right. I think he's right. To a large degree, that ring certainly factors in. We see him, you know, thumbing it later on. And that's a defining moment for him.
I want to see if they keep this up as like a motif, like whenever he's wrestling with his conscience, if he like, you know, fiddles with his ring or something.
House card style.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. We go back to Chuck, who is criticizing the way that Ernesto is fulfilling his grocery list, and he's passive aggressively making some changes to it.
Poor Ernie.
Yeah. How many days do you think he's been doing this? It seemed to me like maybe a week. I mean, probably as long as Jimmy's been gone.
Yeah, so, and we know that's been exactly a week, right? Mm-hmm. So in 7 days, he's got this... Can you imagine the unmitigated disaster the first day was?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's almost right.
You forgot the ice! What am I going to do without ice?
Yeah, right. I feel like now that we know who Chuck is, that this... I'm less willing to write this off as kind of just... what do you call that? Not erratic behavior.
Eccentricities.
Yeah, that's right. Eccentric. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's less eccentric and just him being kind of a dick.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's... Come on, Chuck.
Like,
man.
And he's like...
He's complaining about what type of apples he's getting you.
Also, just like the fact that there's no gratitude here. It's all, I'm entitled to this.
And I know you're going to fuck this up again tomorrow, so write it down.
Yeah.
Chuck, come on.
Like, this is the kind of shit I expect a personal assistant to, like, Mariah Carey to go through. I get you're important to the firm, but goddamn, man.
They've done a brilliant job of making me turn a corner on both Chuck and Hamlin this season.
Yeah, and not with any kind of weird, usual suspect style recontextualizing. Just, I'm going to give you a new piece of information, and then you can go back and get your mental picture adjusted.
Yeah. I think it's been masterful.
Rewatching this season is going to be interesting because now I'm going to be... I can't wait to look at the Hamlin scenes, and I can't wait to see look at the Chuck scenes through different eyes.
Mm-hmm. So Jimmy's outside. Chuck sees him, and he almost goes out there to talk to Jimmy, but he's gone before he can.
Why was Jimmy doing that? Just to make sure that his brother's being taken care of?
I think so.
I felt like
you know,
it
he's coming back. I think he's going to stop in one last time, see how he is.
I don't think it's going to be one last time.
Well, if he thought he was moving to El Paso, then I think he probably assumed it was one last time.
Not El Paso, Santa Fe.
Or, wherever.
That's true. Santa Fe. That's true. Or at least it's going to be a while. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. That tracks.
So Mike gets a call. He's out in the troll booth. He's got another job, and Jimmy drives into the lot. And he's a little surprised to see him there. Jimmy gets out of his car, starts to go inside the courthouse for the meeting with this other firm about the job. But then he turns around. He decides not to go. Instead, he drives up to Mike at the booth and asks him, why didn't we keep the money?
Sure.
What were we thinking?
Yep.
Mike says, you know, I was paid to do a job. I'm going to do the job. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And then Jimmy vows never to let what stopped him before stop him again. And I want to ask you, what do you think stopped Jimmy before?
It seems to me the desire to be the image of what his brother wanted him to be. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what got him out of that life. Even his professional responsibility to his clients is what brought him, you know, away from Cicero and back to New Mexico. That was the impetus.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to define because it's a very nebulous. It's kind of like my conscience, I guess. It's my conscience that was keeping me up.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
And there again, like, I guess that's interesting because the Kettlemans are exactly the kind of mark Jimmy would love to get. It's a guilt-free crime.
Yeah.
I'm robbing someone who robbed society of this money.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And he was still trying to be good guy Jimmy.
And for what? And for what?
Just to get betrayed. Nothing stabbed in the back.
Nothing has changed except for the city's got $1.6 million that they're going to fucking blow on some stupid thing anyway. They're going to feed the homeless or, you know, provide food stamps to kids. Or
sure.
Like, oh, that,
but, I mean, it's worse than that, right? It's not just that he doesn't have this money. It's that the betrayal there. I mean, the betrayal, it goes deeper than just a brother not wanting to work with his brother. It's a brother who kind of forced him out of his life into this new life that he didn't want and resents and doesn't like and has now gone and worked directly against him in the pursuits that his brother told him he wanted in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, Chuck is the one that pushed him into this, and now Chuck is the one holding him back.
It's like, oh, the law is sacred? I turned down $1.6 million out of respect for ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a
try to do what you wanted me to do, but this whole time you've been the thing stopping me.
You know, it'd be interesting. I don't know if it'd be interesting. It might be just a little too coy, but it'd be interesting to see if Chuck could withstand a test of character like that. As entitled as he is.
Yeah.
Like, if next year he gets the opportunity to pocket $1 million with no one looking over his shoulder and he takes that and then goes off to Belize.
Yeah, it would be interesting, definitely. Because I still do believe that Chuck respects the law, and that may be the only thing that he's really super concerned about.
And Jimmy does say
about.
He's a sick man, because that's the other thing. Mm-hmm. Before we start, you know, hanging the unwashed asshole tag on Chuck,
uh-huh.
We don't know what the hell happened to him.
That's true.
Although it's hard to excuse the mailroom betrayal.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Like, yeah, maybe his wife left him. Maybe all this shit blew up, or maybe he just had a nervous breakdown, whatever. It doesn't seem like he was suffering any on some of the stuff that he put Jimmy through.
You're right.
So, but having said that, there's a lot of room for them to kind of fill in the gaps of Chuck and see exactly.
I can't imagine. So, I mean, maybe I could be proven wrong about this, but I can't imagine a scenario in which Chuck's sickness allows him to betray his brother in that way that makes it okay.
No, I don't think there's a justification, but maybe like, well, I understand. Because I honestly understand him going and laying down the law on Cicero.
I kind of already understand why he doesn't want Jimmy to be a lawyer and to work with him.
All right, there's a
because
there's
Jimmy's there's slipping Jimmy at his core, but eventually you've got to let that image of Jimmy go.
Right.
Although, 10 years down the road...
Yeah.
That's a much harder image to keep in your head, and Chuck seems to be able to do it just fine.
And also, Chuck doesn't see Jimmy putting, you know, turning down $1.6 million. All Chuck sees is the billboard scheme.
But he's got to see every day he's bringing him ice and food, and he's busting his ass in the mailroom and at nights to get a law degree.
None
of that changes his mind.
Yeah.
Chuck is too focused on who Jimmy was and not enough focused on who Jimmy can be and wants to be.
Which has turned it into a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly.
You got the chimp with a machine gun now.
You do. You do. So I thought it was interesting Mike's still on the job. It let us know, you know, Mike's still doing things for this vet. That was not his last job that we saw. So it sets up a lot of stuff for next season.
Yeah, working a crossword puzzle. The other thing that kind of leads credence to the greater Gollum ring theory is that, to my knowledge, Jimmy didn't know that that's the song Marco was humming when he died.
Smoke on the Water.
On the Water, and then he pulls out of the parking lot with a ring on his finger, humming Smoke on the Water.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a badass song that people hum from time to time when they're feeling like a badass. So,
So one other question about this scene, another big question.
Yeah.
I view Jimmy's motivations as probably threefold here as to why he decides to never let his brother or his goodwill get in the way of himself again. One of those is Fuck Chuck. I certainly think that's in there.
Banana Fanta.
Another one is probably to honor his dead friend Marco. I think there was a certain...
There definitely was that. I don't think we've talked about that enough. The death of Marco.
Him thumbing that ring
at
the end, to me, says... Probably the other one is life is too short.
Sure.
And he doesn't want to get burned over and over again by the people who trust him. So, sure. Or who he trusts. So he's going to not trust anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt like it was a little bit to honor Marco. Like, this is who I was. This is who I'm going to be. Marco's going to be with me through this journey.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Those were the kind of three things that I thought.
No, I totally subscribe to your theory.
Okay.
I also think that maybe Jimmy's just very impressionable by peer pressure, because there's also the element of, I feel like when Marco's going on and on about, like, oh my God, you got a law degree. Well, I mean, you can really run scams and you can really make the big bank. And
it's true.
Like, this is a different idea. You know, there's the idea of what kind of lawyer Chuck wants him to be. And there's the idea of what kind of lawyer you can be, you know?
Okay.
You don't want, do you want to be Matlock or do you want to be Levy from The Wire? You know, with the briefcase and the shotgun. Mm-hmm. This felt so definitive of a change. It's going to be, and I'm never going to say never now that I've seen this first season and I was naysaying and nervous and all this, and this has been a really great first season. We'll be talking about towards the end of the cast about how great and how it stacks up against everything else. But that's one thing I'm very curious about. How are they going to keep the essential dichotomy of his good versus evil nature, that's kind of what drove the Breaking Bad train too.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
with Walt,
how are they going to keep that alive when he's made a definitive, you know?
Yeah. The rest of this series can't just be Saul scamming.
True. But they did a lot of that. I mean, they did a lot of that stuff with Walt, and it's kind of a cycle, and it was a further descent every single time. So I guess it's probably naive of us to think that, oh, it's going to be white caddies and cheap suits and Lady Liberties next season.
No, definitely not.
There's a couple more downward spirals that you got to go through.
One of those big spirals is going to have to be with Kim.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be. I mean, his new life is not going to sit well with her at all.
Well, not only that, she stuck her nose out and went on
and he just
stuck her neck, rather. And just totally blew it off.
Yeah.
And it surprised me because I thought was going to be interesting, and this is my pet theory, that his original sin with this stuff with Tuco and Nacho, you know, Nacho's going to be inside the door waiting for him. I don't know how or why he would be there,
uh-huh.
But like, you know, he gets waylaid and he can't make the meeting and he can't tell Kim why, and that's going to be a huge stressor. Hmm. Him just blowing off the meeting and be like, fuck it.
It's even better.
That is a fuck you. And I guess
it's a choice he made, right? It's
also stuff that he could probably talk to Kim and smooth it over. Like, look, I went to Cicero. I saw like an old buddy of mine from my youth and he died. And then this on top of Chuck, I just lost my mind. I mean,
he can smooth that over. But when she sees what he's going to become.
Yes.
That's where it's going to get difficult.
Yes. But I think
the relationship is going to strain
to start, like, instead of a slow slip, he just blows her off and embarrasses her professionally. that's, you know, I don't know. It's
she's going back to the cornfield.
It does feel like they painted themselves in the corner. And I know that that's something that Vince has said before he enjoys doing. Putting them in situations that he has no idea how they're going to get at and relying on ingenuity of the team. And presumably Gould feels the same way.
I don't feel like this is a corner. I feel like this is a dead end for him and Kim. Like I think this is going to be the destruction of the relationship, not something that he has to overcome to make it all roses again.
Like in a Skyler White type destruction of relationship, because the thing that it feels like they spent way too much time building up their relationship, and even, you know, when he got that hug and he's like, "Oh, that was nice." I mean, they spent way too much time building up this relationship to make it a dead end.
Maybe it's not going to happen immediately.
No, I see what you're saying.
But this doesn't go. They don't live happily ever after. Is my point?
No. Well,
and this is definitely the beginning of that. When Saul makes the conscious decision to be a bad person, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that he's making. Okay, there's the distinction, right? There's Mike's distinction of being a bad person or good person and breaking the law. Two separate things. I don't think Saul is a bad person or Jimmy is a bad person necessarily.
But he will be.
But he has certainly made the decision to start breaking and bending the law.
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of the same conversation with Breaking Bad. When did Walt break bad? You know?
Sure.
This is perhaps the turning down Gretchen and Elliot. Working at the, you know, legitimately taking care of the problems that got you into this thing. Mm-hmm. This might be the tip of that, or like, you know, where a reasonable person can say, yes, this is where he broke bad.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm super interested in tracking that the way we did Breaking Bad.
We kind of have been, though.
Just I know.
Tangentially through our discussions.
But it's like, I don't know what people listen to podcasts think, but when I think like, oh, spending three seasons doing this, I'm like, ugh. Like, that's not super interesting, or it's interesting, but we've done it already.
We have.
And I feel like at some point the other guys making this shit have to feel that way too. Like they have, it cannot be just a tamer retelling of Breaking Bad. And it hasn't been that way so far. It's been a kind of its own, you know, it's like weirdly Breaking Bad was a good man resisting the temptation to be bad and failing. This is a bad man that's resisting the temptation to be good and succeeding.
Yeah, which is an inherently more
interesting tale. It's the chiral form. It's the chiral form of Breaking Bad.
You're absolutely right. This is chiral Breaking Bad. One other thing, I was talking with my girlfriend while we were kind of simul-watching this across the internet.
Sure.
And she mentioned something about the bingo scene that I hadn't picked up on, which I thought was really interesting, is how the balls in the bingo machine sound like boiling water, and they start getting louder and louder through the episode, and you can kind of feel what's going on in Saul's head as he's thinking about
this. Is that a callback to him being stuck with that boiler in his small office, that this is another pressure cooker situation?
Yeah, I think so. And that's it for the episode.
All right. Before we get to feedback, as is Bald Move tradition, we got to pay some bills because they're not going to pay themselves. Don't have any Kettlemans to extort for $20,000/$40,000. We are a listener-based independent podcast network that's primarily backed by you, the listener. Whether you use our Amazon affiliate link at amazon.baldmove.com or club.baldmove.com, which is what I want to talk to you about today, because I think you get a great value for your money. First of all, you can skip our ads with their ad-free feeds. That's got to be a plus, right?
And I'm working on getting those in separate feeds too. So
for those of you that want it,
going to be enhanced very soon.
Yeah, you get to watch us record the podcast live, which gets them out a couple hours early, which is super significant on like instant cast and stuff like that. And you get access to our VIP section on the forums at forums.baldmove.com. You get access to Lunch with Jim and Aaron, where you can hang out with us on Fridays and ask us questions and watch us do goofy stuff and have goofy conversations. A lot more. And the other thing is, this is just going to get better. We're going to keep piling on features and adding new things to the website and new pieces of content. And most importantly, it helps us make the podcast, because without your support, we could not do this. And man, I don't want to be in a position where I have to make a tough decision about whether I want to do Walking Dead or Better Call Saul or Mad Men or Game of Thrones next year. I would love to keep doing what I'm doing, which is be able to do everything for everyone. Mm-hmm. The only way I can do that is if you help us out. Go to club.baldmove.com, check out the pitch, see some examples of all the great content. And if you can spare as low as a dollar a month, you can help keep Bald Move humming along. And again, thanks for coming with us on this first season. Thanks to everyone who has supported us through the club and will continue to do so. And just can't say enough about how grateful I am that you guys allow us to do this awesome job. Shall we do feedback?
Yeah.
I've got this segment in roughly three strata, some takes on Pimento, which I thought were unusually strong since it was an unusually strong episode. So haven't done this a lot, but we're going back. Then we got some current episode thoughts. Then we got some wrap-up thoughts. Strata the first. Charlie O said, you ask who Lalo, whom Saul referred to in the desert in Breaking Bad, was.
Yeah.
Spanish name abbreviations can be a bit unusual, but I'm pretty sure, even if they didn't intend it when they wrote the Breaking Bad episode, is that Lalo is Don Eladio. Eladio can be abbreviated to Leo. Gotta be Layo. But given Saul's lousy Spanish, I'll give him a slip or two. Do you think this is... I mean, we know that Tuco's connected, so by definition, Nacho is.
I mean... By admission, the listener is stretching a bit, but only a bit.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that might be right. Like, sure. I could totally see Don Eladio being a big part of maybe even the end of season two.
I wouldn't mind seeing the character. And we know that
He feels like a season three character, given the chain of connections that have to happen through Gus and all that.
I can't remember if we got feedback on this. Maybe we did, maybe didn't. Because sometimes when I do all my reading, it runs together. Did you think Ernesto / Ernie was a conscious homage to Gus Fring, a foreshadowing?
Because
they bear a kind of...
I didn't pick up on it, but maybe.
They bear kind of a physical resemblance, the precision in dress and like the posture and just the kind of genteelness. I didn't see that going into it, but when I read...
I didn't either.
When I read a few reviews and I saw... You know, I think as Steppenwall said, he thought it was kind of an obvious homage. When I went back and saw it the second time, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Maybe if he was wearing a yellow shirt, I would have made that connection.
Yeah, and khakis. Yeah, Gould didn't deny it either in his interview.
So it must be true.
It must be true. Reginald, two things I would have liked to seen differently. It would have been, one, it would have been nice to have been kept in the dark as long as Jimmy was. And remember, this is for Pimento. That way, we could have fed all of his rage, shock, and abandonment as he was feeling them when he interacted with Howard and Kim. But by showing us Chuck making that call, there was little suspense. We just went through the episode saying, poor, poor Jimmy. He's being played by his brother. What do you think of that?
Not totally. The call was a little more, I guess, innocuous than he's giving it credit for. He's saying, oh, it spelled it all out right there on the screen.
Sure.
I don't think that's true.
I think a reasonably sharp viewer knew something was up.
Definitely you thought something was up, but I wasn't, at least me personally, I wasn't sure exactly what was happening.
Yeah, and this is my relationship with spoilers. Like, very rarely do spoilers ruin things for me because, yes, I was robbed of the, you know, kind of visceral thrill of seeing something unfold for the first time, but... knowing it's coming, I can see some of the nuances that first-time viewers would miss and appreciate it that way. So, yes, we do miss out on the I am in Jimmy's shoes in like a first-person perspective, but we also lost the kind of seeing this tragic inevitability and the, you know, it made the scene with him and Kim much more painful, knowing that he is upbraiding her. Because if we didn't have the phone scene, it's entirely within Kim's character to kind of be this, I don't know what you'd call that, like Benedict Arnold, to kind of be like her. It's kind of like her to carry H&M's water.
Definitely.
So, you know, but by knowing that he is so wrong and she is trying to spare him pain, it makes that scene more poignant. So it's kind of like tomato, tomato.
Yeah,
six of one, half dozen the other.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just not good at reading plot devices or what, but it seems to me the things that give away intentions and what's going to happen next is the performances of really good actors. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, I mean, the scene where Chuck is confronted with his brother's law degree told me right away that he was not comfortable with that. And then the scene where they're having the meeting with Hamlin and Jimmy wants to be a partner in the in Pimento, Chuck's performance there told me that he doesn't want him to be partner.
Yeah.
Like, I could tell just by the looks that Hamlin was giving Chuck, the way Chuck was reacting, that that was what was going on. It wasn't the phone just call that gave it away for me. It was the performances.
Okay.
And a lot of shows don't, you don't get that from.
Sure.
I mean, this is, there are some exceptional actors in here.
Two, Howard makes such a good villain, they should have kept him as one. His patronizing air is just a finely crafted mask. His real personality was seen when he sneered at Kim about not needing her opinion. But then to stop her and reveal that it was all Chuck's idea makes him a sympathetic figure. Poor Howard, he did the dirty work for Chuck by telling Jimmy he wouldn't be hired when he first became a lawyer. Poor Howard, he has to play the part of the bad guy and take Jimmy's case away at the behest of Chuck. I can take Chuck being a manipulative, jealous jerk, but I would like to keep Howard as a bad guy too.
I think there will be if Breaking Bad is any indication, I think there will be plenty of good villains in our future. I thought it was a brilliant stroke to turn Hamlin on a dime like that.
Yeah,
in our minds.
Honestly, I like it when they can catch me with a little bit of audience judo, you know.
Now, and I will say going I was definitely thinking, man, Hamlin's going to be a villain for a long time to come.
Sure.
He's going to fuck over this case, screw Jimmy on it, and steal it from him, and Jimmy's going to try to get revenge. I was thinking all those things, and I was thinking how great they'd be.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I really like what they did with it.
Mm-hmm. It certainly complicates things between Chuck and Jimmy, which I like complicated things.
Yeah.
Chris A said, I have a slightly different take on Charles. While I'm not excusing Chuck's actions, I wonder if the major turn back to his disdain for Jimmy came from the billboard incident. Chuck's initial burn came from his disdain for Jimmy's correspondence degree. However, I think that by the time we start Better Call Saul, Chuck actually appreciates Jimmy for what he is, a low-rent public defender. I think he truly appreciates all that Jimmy has done for him as a caretaker. I think he may have even been on his way to accepting Jimmy as a genuine lawyer. I want to pause here real quick with Chris and say that I actually think this is an interesting take because you can see kind of every time Jimmy tells Chuck something, in retrospect, there's this kind of like weighing in Chuck's mind, like, do I think this is something that's good enough or what's the reverse of good enough? If this is
bad
low
enough?
Rent enough? No, not bad enough, but like, is this appropriate for his station in life?
Oh,
like being a partner at my firm, you need to stay in your lane. But being a public defender, grinding cases out, yeah, we need guys. Like, we need legal janitors. That's something. Elder law, that's an underserved thing. That's a, yeah, Jimmy, you can do elder law. It's when he tries to fly, like when he gets a multi-million-dollar case based on his mistake. You know, when he gets a law degree that's every bit as good as Chuck's. You know, as far as the, you know, what you can actually do with
as far as the paper it's written on. Yeah.
Not saying the University of America Samoa is as good and all that stuff, but
yeah,
I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah. I think he's right. I think it is very different when you go back and you watch it because the billboard thing he's super concerned about and Jimmy knows it.
Yeah.
And Jimmy says, look, this is not slipping Jimmy. This is not what it is. That is not who I am anymore. But wondering whether or not Chuck buys that is totally valid.
So put a pin in our emotional intellectual engagement at in this layer, and Chris continues. Then comes the billboard incident. Jimmy uses an updated slipping Jimmy routine to boost his business and to take a shot at Chuck's own firm. Jimmy even goes the lengths of covering it up from his brother because he knows Chuck will see it for it is. Sure, Chuck had to face his fears and his betrayal of Jimmy, but Jimmy's betrayal made Chuck have to face his fears, first to retrieve his neighbor's paper, and ultimately led to his arrest and hospitalization. I'm by no means saying that Chuck has done the right thing here, but I'm simply wondering if this incident didn't lead to Chuck's belief that slipping Jimmy will never truly be gone.
That's fair.
That is fair. And I'm glad they threw in the fact that he fucked him out of a job at his law firm, because if it hadn't been for that scene and making Hamlin go down there and crush him in his moment of very small triumph, this would make Chuck seem almost entirely too reasonable. Because, the $20 million on the back of you pulling a slipping Jimmy stunt, this is bullshit. So I'm glad they put that in because it does leave him a little bit more ambiguous.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is totally righteous in this situation.
Sure.
They've all made mistakes, and they all continue to make mistakes.
Yep. David M. said, Jim, you said that you didn't have time to play the name game or didn't have to play the name game for Pimento because sure. It was too obvious.
It's a sandwich, yeah.
But Mike calls it Southern Caviar, which is something cheap masquerading as something respectable, which is exactly what Chuck thinks of Jimmy. I like that.
Yeah, it does describe Jimmy in a way.
You out-name gamed us there, David. Mm-hmm. Moving on to new stuff from Marco, the finale. Ivan from Winnipeg says, great season. I think we're seeing the makings of a classic. To start, I'd like to note the return of the pig fucker. Perhaps AMC is testing moral waters. All right, we'll have one naked woman tied to a tree with her organs hanging out on The Walking Dead. Better Call Saul gets two fucks a season. Do you think the AMC is trying to, like, look, they're looking at HBO and saying, why not us?
Why not them?
Nothing from only them afraid of the FCC doing something that they're not currently doing keeps them from going full tits, full gore, full fucks.
You're right. Can I just say that the arc of AMC as a network will have been very Walter White-like, very Walter White-like if they go to HBO standards.
Yeah, 10 years from now, I want the
American movie classics showing biblical, black and white films 24/7 has turned into the HBO.
Yeah, that what happens when the American Movie Classics channel turns into Scarface? that's pretty funny. There should be a documentary about that. It turns out it's all smoking ad execs and meth.
Yep.
That's what happens. He continues, Ivan does. I love the finale. The return of Slipping Jimmy was entertaining as all hell. I would have loved the bottle episode with Jimmy and Marco just watching their little cons fully unfold. Great idea for some minisodes. I would not mind seeing a webisode, like 5 minutes each of them, like kind of like the Kennedy scam for every one of these things.
That'd be cool.
That would really get me Jones for season two. Also, it could have been interesting if maybe he and Marco got in some trouble with one of their scams, forcing Jimmy to use his law experience to get him out of a local jam in a really greasy way. After his victory, he realizes his destiny being the lawyer for guilty people. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that it's a missed opportunity. You know, kind of like your bingo thing because, you know,
it was already so good.
It's not like, sure if I want a Monday or Tuesday morning showrunner, Vince Gilligan and Peter fucking Gould.
Yeah.
But that's a cool idea. Mm-hmm. That's a very cool idea. I think next season we'll see the caterpillar that is Jimmy McGill or James McGill Esquire emerge as a beautiful Saul Goodman butterfly.
Yeah.
I think we're also going to see Mike do progressively nastier jobs, which will undoubtedly be done in the most badass way possible. I'm very optimistic about what we'll see next season and very curious about what Jimmy's first move as Saul Goodman might be. Another interesting thing I picked up in one of the Gould interviews is that he believes that Mike is not ready for Gus. He said just as his opinion is Jimmy's not ready to fully embrace Saul, Mike, sure, he murdered two cops, but that was vengeance for his broken boy. Sure, he's... you know, backed up a low stakes drug deal armed with only a pimento sandwich, but he's a ways away from putting little kids in barrels, you know?
That sounds right to me.
So, Mike H on second viewing, I recognized, this is a theory that I wasn't going to read, but then I'm like, you know, we should go and listen and check it out. And, we'll let Jim do the commentary after I get done reading it. Mike H, on second viewing, I thought I recognized Bryan Cranston's voice for a brief moment as a man named Manny Hollinger, leaving the last message on Jimmy's phone as he went through his voicemail in the scene waking up in Marco's apartment. Go back and hear it for yourself.
Yes, Mr. McGill. This is Manny Hollinger.
What's your take on this? Because we listened to this several times.
My take is that it's not Bryan Cranston. It does sound quite a bit like him. But at the same time, I won't say I'm sure of that.
I would, if I was a Mythbuster, I'd mark this as plausible.
Yes. And the coughing masks it a lot.
Because the key thing is,
I could see them doing this.
Everything I know about Vince, Peter, and Brian tells me that this is a slam dunk. Brian, can we get you to call in and leave a message?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes.
And it's not like they need him on set or anything. It's just like, call my phone and leave me a voicemail as Manny Hollinger.
Yes, and it's the kind of cool kind of fan service that's at an Easter egg. The only thing against it is in this internet day, I'm predisposed to not believe something. 48 hours after it aired, I feel like I should go on the internet and search, did Bryan Cranston leave a voicemail message on... Marco and get hits from something that the people knows, but maybe Mike, you're the first.
Could be.
In which case you get you're eligible for all the internet points. Bill from New Jersey says, I really dug the finale. Might not have been the emotional high point of the series, which he would give the Pimento or 5-0. What gets it for you? Pimento or 5-0?
Man, Pimento. I like Mike's episode and that, was good, but I would Pimento.
never believe me if you'd have just laid out the plot line for Pimento, because I didn't think Bob had it in him, but I kind of think so too.
Yeah,
as good as Mike's was, Pimento was just a hair better for me, because you also got a good. Also, it helped that you got a pretty good helping of Mike in that episode too.
You did. You definitely
Whereas
did.
And 5-0
there were
was
funny
all.
Scenes and stuff like that. I mean, 5-0 wasn't funny at all.
Well, you had this coffee. Yeah, you're right. No, it wasn't really funny.
Almost nothing funny in that episode. It was very drama heavy. It was very dark, very dreary. And like I said, I don't know. I like.
I do
a
expect
bit of
that to
sunshine.
Be a kind of controversial opinion. I feel like that. It wouldn't surprise me if 50-50 of the fans, or even 75-25, like 5-0 better, because it is a grittier, more Breaking Bad episode of Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but this finale definitely sets up Jimmy for a major turn towards being a criminal, a lawyer in season 2. My only complaint was Marco's heart attack. It felt a little fish NATO 737 down to me. Too convenient and too easy. What did you guys think?
They laid the groundwork in the scene where Jimmy comes back. He's got a little cough. I knew something was up there.
And he just seems like he's a guy who spent the last 10 years just abusing his body.
Sure.
The desperation and the emotional duress that he showed at the thought of Jimmy leaving and knowing that this is the last time he could ever. I mean, I feel like I can speak with some authority on the fish NATO-y aspect of scenes, but it didn't even trip my fish NATO sensor.
Okay.
But I could have been, you know, I'm honestly, not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying it didn't trip it for me.
You know, you put an obese man on the screen and I believe a heart attack at any moment.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it might be a coincidental, we need this heart attack to happen now sort of thing.
Sure.
But a heart attack could happen to a man like that at any moment.
Yeah. Now, if Fargo had set up that there is like a giant fish hatchery a mile down the road and there's tornado warnings
and on the radio
there you go. That's all I need. Jack K says, when Jimmy gets to Cicero, he tells Marco that while he is there, he wants to get a hot dog at Henry's. Well, here, sir, is a pic of the place just a few blocks from my office. He sends in a picture of the real Henry's where you can get presumably a hot dog.
Nice.
It's good to see that unlike Walking Dead, the writers know their locale. Even the basement was spot on. My only bitch is the old style beer at the place, because apparently in Cicero, all you can get is a Miller or Bud Light. I think that this is 100% attributable to Bob Odenkirk, because he is from this area and he is bringing that local flavor for you. It's just a damn shame they couldn't get a day or two to shoot actually at this location. It's kind of like, you know, what they do with ABQ. Since Cicero is a big part of the plot in this season, I wish they could have gotten a week to shoot some scenes there. That would have been really cool.
Man, I'm still not sure that they're not in Chicago. Him yelling about LaSalle.
Yeah.
I mean, LaSalle is such a major street in Chicago.
Sure, but I'm at this point, I don't know that there's a distinction now that I've seen the geography. Like, that's like saying Fountain.
I don't know how like, that's far like LaSalle saying, goes.
I'm not sure this happened in Fountain Square. I think it was Indianapolis. Like, okay.
I'm just wondering if LaSalle goes to Cicero. I mean, LaSalle is definitely a major thoroughfare, but it's...
Well,
mostly associated with downtown.
I don't want to spend too much time dwelling because I'm feeling more and more lazy not just get on Google Maps and figure it out.
There is no Sherman Street, though. I mean,
okay,
you might be able to go to Cicero and say, oh, there's no LaSalle Street. And if that's the case, then it must be Chicago. But whatever. Ultimately, it doesn't matter, right?
That's the only reason I haven't looked it up, because I just don't give a shit.
Okay.
Alex C. found the death of Marco lacking. Let's face it. Marco is not a good dude. By his own admission, he was only ever happy when he's ripping someone off. I'm sure Jimmy loved him, but as an audience member, it was tough to care. In fact, I can honestly say every single death on Breaking Bad hit me harder than Marco. What do you think, when he actually helpfully clicked on a YouTube, or give me a YouTube clip that has every single death in Breaking Bad?
Yeah, here's the one flaw I see, and something that I think we have to point out, or we would be hypocrites a little bit.
Mm.
They only really develop Marco as a character during the episode where they kill him. That is something that we give Walking Dead a lot of shits for.
Yeah.
A lot of shit. I felt that watching this episode, it didn't have the effect, the punch that it needed to have, especially coming off of Pimento last week.
Well,
with a much bigger punch.
I agree. My only question is, did you think that the ghoul and the Villigan really wanted us to feel an emotional punch at Marco? Because to me, Marco's death was a pivot point to move, Jimmy closer to Saul. And
I feel like they should have maybe flip-flopped those, though, because I don't buy that if his brother wasn't enough to push him over the edge, that the death of Marco would have been, because I haven't seen enough of their relationship, I guess. I mean, I know they were buddies and scamming together and stuff, but the connection to Chuck must have been far greater than his connection to Marco. And so for that to be kind of the thing that finally pushes him over the edge to be Saul doesn't feel right to me. It feels like he should have done those in reverse order.
Well, it makes it... I feel like Jimmy's struggling with Chuck's betrayal. Going into Better Call, going into Saul from that point would seem more like a negative reaction. It's more of something driven by the desire to, like, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Whereas doing it because as a result of the death of Marco makes it feel more like an affirmative decision to do that.
Okay. I can buy that.
You know, again, it's like a very slight distinction, and there's certainly elements of vengeance and I'll show you in that final scene.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the way it worked for me anyway. And I never felt anything for Marco other than, you know, oh, poor guy, and well, Jimmy's affected. But I never suspected I was supposed to, like,
yeah,
feel a punch in the gut, like presumably you're supposed to feel when a major character on The Walking Dead dies.
Sure, yeah.
Matthew C., an expat living in the UK, says, is it just me, or did you guys think Jimmy was going to walk into the meeting with Davis and Maine and meet the guy he and Marco conned back in the bar out of $110? It'd be a crazy coincidence, but I would thought it would be good, as if the universe was against Jimmy's hope to go straight. There again, don't want a Tuesday morning quarterback, but yeah, that would have been also a really cool idea.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. I like it.
The only thing I could see them wrestling in the writer's room with, like, Nacho coming out of the shadows, or you motherfucker, you ran the scam on me, is it kind of takes the agency out of Jimmy.
Yeah.
And I feel like the dead story they want to tell is a man and how he makes decisions in the face of adversity or lack thereof.
Yeah, and that's the thing that always drove Breaking Bad too, right? The decisions that Walt was consciously making to a point. I mean, some things happened to him,
sure, that he
but
had
most
to
of
do.
The things he did to himself, and yeah. and it caused the things that happened to him. So
yeah, and that's a good
point.
I
like that formula.
Like in season one, he was kind of, yeah, he made the decision to cook meth, but a lot of the blood on his hands, he was forced. They were acts of self-defense.
Sure.
Season two, that line started getting really blurred, leading to the climax.
Stay out of
season.
My territory. Like,
yeah,
that's him making a conscious decision there.
And then by the time you get Gale, it's like, wow. Yeah. So moving on, Andrew B. from Texas. While it's well documented that Smoke on the Water is about a fire at Frank Zappa concert, which displaced Deep Purple while recording an album in Switzerland. That it's well documented, but I had no idea about any of this stuff.
Sure.
But in true Villigan fashion, there are several lines that seem to reference Jimmy's current and future circumstances as we end the season finale, and he has gone over to the dark side. He then quotes Deep Purple thusly, Frank Zappa and the Mothers were at the best place around, but some stupid with a flare gun burned the place to the ground. He parenthetically translates, this is Jimmy skipping the meeting and effectively ending his pursuit of a clean-cut life and his brother's approval. He's burning that bridge. Mm. When it was all over, we had to find another place. We ended up at the Grand Hotel. It was empty, cold, and bare. Again, he translates his future building of the highly successful law office of criminal attorney Saul Goodman. But as we see in Breaking Bad, he is alone without Kim or Chuck in his life any longer. We made a place to sweat. No matter what we can get out of this, I know we'll never forget the eventual demise of his practice and subsequent going into hiding. And as seen in episode one, despite his what his life has become in Omaha, he still reminisces about and pines for his glory days as Saul Goodman. What do you think? Is it a little too color theory for you? Or
it's yeah, it's a a little too reachy for me.
All right. I appreciate this coming from the Dead Man's Brew.
Yes.
Low blow.
Yes.
I appreciate your textual analysis, Andrew, and Thank you for your email. Finally, a little fun note for the listeners. Rachel B. said, I couldn't believe that Mike's daughter-in-law is played by the crazy Irish lady who tried to feed Rick Grimes to her Walker husband in the woods near the prison. I find it hard to believe myself. We have verified it. It is played by the same actress.
Yeah.
I just shut the tab down and I don't know what her name is.
Her name is Carrie Condon.
There you go.
And it's hard to tell with all the gunk on her in that episode, but yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah, she looks as much as a zombie as she actually does eventually as a zombie.
Yeah.
But good work working your way up the AMC ladder from name zombie woman whose name I didn't remember to Stacy the Mantra.
It's a big step up.
Sure. Finally, we got some wrap-up thoughts.
Okay.
You ready? This is for the season as a whole. Joe E. says, this team is a collection of master storytellers. Little things like bringing back the smoke on the water home, the dented trash can, the pinky ring, and they do it without any shocking death or twist endings. Better Call Saul will never be the best ever like Breaking Bad and isn't as high stakes, but this enables us to appreciate the writer's narrative craft even more.
I couldn't agree more. I think these guys are great at what they do.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that's what it takes to make the type of television that Breaking Bad is, and to take what I felt was not a super good premise with Better Call Saul and make it into something that is not only watchable, but very, very good.
No, the first season, if it did anything, and it did a lot of things, it showed that you cannot put the show into a box. Whatever your expectations are, you can't say it's just going to be one thing or just the other. Well, they can't do this storyline because I feel like the talent that they have, they could do about anything.
It seems like it.
Do you two think that it's originally Chuck who tried to make Jimmy change his law firm name in the first place? We never saw Howard get upset about it until the billboard went up.
It might be.
I think it's 100%.
Yeah.
That had to come like, oh God, we really need this guy to change his name. I'm personally embarrassed.
Yeah. If he doesn't want him associated with the law, he doesn't want him associated with his name either.
Exactly. Was it really feasible to do all those scams in 1 week? Answer, who cares? It was a fun scene.
I have no problem with it.
I forgot to ask you, what did you think? Did you think that went on too long? Because I loved it. I thought it was stylish.
The scamtage.
And visually interesting. And
it felt like something the Coen brothers would do, honestly.
Yeah?
To me. I don't know if that's just I have the Big Lebowski in my head because this guy looks like that private detective.
Did have a lot of little, you know, kind of like the fantastical elements of Big Lebowski into it.
Yeah, and the music they're using is, I don't know, Coen-esque. And I didn't. The first time I watched it, I thought, man, this is going on a while. I don't know if I like this. Mm-hmm. Second time through, it went much quicker. But I was taking notes, so maybe that was part of it. My overall impression after having seen it three times, actually, is it didn't go on too long.
Okay. That's probably I find that to be the most accurate. Because like I find myself, when I'm watching things I'm predisposed to kind of be on guard for, like my guard goes up and I'm like, I don't know about this. But then when I watch it again, I know it's coming. So my guard's a little bit relaxed. Like, yeah, that's all. That's fine.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's like, no, that's totally horseshit. lastly, I love this first season overall. I like the first two episodes when they came out. I just rewatched them and I'm coming around to Jim's opinion, though. I think most of us saw the potential of the two-part pilot and looked past the flaws and celebrated when they turned the corner. Those twins are unwatchable and Tuco is out of place. The last eight have been amazing, but Jim is right. And parentheses, don't tell Jim. Well,
Jesus.
Shit. It's too late now.
Well, now I'm just, my head's inflating.
Can't fit out the studio door.
No.
I I suspected that's true, but I feel like it's going to be rough rewatching those first two episodes, knowing what is coming.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't think the first one is all that bad. I think it's the second one where they really just kind of don't hit the notes that they should have hit fast enough.
I understand why they did it. I just feel like it's going to be a weak rewatch in a way that
those
really,
first couple don't compare, I think, to the rest of the season.
You know, we've just rewatched the first two seasons of Breaking Bad within recent memory, and none of those episodes at all did I feel like, oh, wow, this was the stinker. Like, no. You know, you watch season one of Star Trek, Next Generation is kind of like through. you're like watching a horror show through laced fingers. Like, oh, God, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I cannot believe what I'm watching.
Just get me to season two.
None of those. But I feel like some of that stuff with Tuco, as much as I like Raymond Cruz, as much as I like that character, it's the only time where I felt like they really gave in to just masturbation.
It felt forced. It really did.
Liz G says, in his review of Better Call Saul episode Marco, Sepinwall said Better Call Saul was in many ways better, or at least more consistent, than the first year of Breaking Bad. I wonder if Sepinwall's ever rewatched Breaking Bad. I recall you two reading his negative reviews during the rewatch podcast of Breaking Bad. I do as well. I disagree with his comments and believe Breaking Bad packed a lot of show in the first and second season. I was repeatedly surprised by how much happened on early Breaking Bad episodes.
Yeah, that was my sentiment too, having recapped those.
I'm amazed that he is saying that in many ways better, or at least more consistent. Now, well, I want to save some of these thoughts for another email, but I don't know, because I've noticed sometimes, and you and I both, I think, have noticed that when we're thinking back to early episodes of stuff that we didn't podcast or we didn't cover in a lot of detail,
yeah,
that we have a snapshot of a season that doesn't necessarily bear up. Like, for many years, we cited Tell It to the Frogs as the worst episode of Walking Dead history. When I rewatched that season to research my book, that episode is fine. It had one line that sucks.
Tell It to the Frogs, yeah.
But it's actually Vatos, which is the terrible episode. Sure. So you can get, like, these things, these you know, brain bugs in your own head, and you remember that version rather than a true version. And I mean, Sepinwall could be, I think during this time, he was kind of like in between his last professional newspaper job and HitFix. He was doing his blog and trying to work the internet angle. It could be that that's kind of like, you know, because he didn't cover it as in depth and as seriously, that he's got this image of season one Breaking Bad, and oh, of course the writer's strike, and of course it got shut, and it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. Like, if he went back and rewatched that first season, I mean,
you know, the other thing that I think makes seasons 1, 2, and 3 of that show look kind of bad in comparison is seasons 4 and 5 being so excellent.
But they're not. They do, like, I thought so too. I thought we'd be in for some rough watches, but
I know, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think it's arguable that seasons 4 and 5 are the best of that show.
Okay.
So and by 6, comparison, like, yeah, you think, man, the show was so great in 4 and 5, and well, I count 5 as both halves of that. So whatever.
Oh yeah, you're right. My fault. Yeah.
But anyway, by comparison, they're not as good as 4 and 5.
Yes.
But they're still excellent. And I think you forget that, remembering, like, oh, 4 and 5 are the seasons, man.
I'm just saying that I saw, when we look at those reviews, and we saw Sepinwall and Pani Wasnik and Mo Ryan, they're really tepid to negative reviews. Like, well, this Bryan Cranston is amazing. It's a revelation. But man, there's a lot of slow stuff. I just don't see it. And I that's their honest opinion, and they're professionals, and I'm not saying they're wrong, but I also remember what I thought about the Breaking Bad pilot, and I remember kind of rewatching it over the last summer and winter, and how impressed I was. It's hard for me to believe. I just don't know what it's like to be a professional critic and plow through 30, you know, premieres and pilots.
That can't be fun.
Yeah. And like, it was at the time of the day, was it just like, you know, were they just coming off of watching Soprano and then they got this and it's like, oh, this is weird, it's AMC, what the fuck. I don't know, but it's hard to explain, and it's kind of I'm just wondering if when Sepinwall's saying it's more consistent, if he's just got this mental image of this truncated season that not everything worked and then really all cylinders fired in season two. I don't know.
I don't think Better Call Saul is that consistent. We've talked about episodes one and two.
Yes. No, I don't think, I do not think you can say it's more consistent than season one of Breaking Bad.
No, I agree with that.
But
I don't think it's inconsistent. I don't think it's as engaging right off the jump.
Yeah.
And the misfire, there are no misfires in season one. Really, there are no misfires in Breaking Bad, period, other than maybe the end of season two.
Yep. I was going to say, I was about to jump in there.
That's the one glaring flaw. To me, the glaring flaw in Better Call Saul so far is episodes one and two.
So, and even I will go so far as to say, if you took out season, if episode two didn't exist or was about 20 minutes shorter,
yeah,
I think you can make a real argument that it is more consistent. Well, it's hard to say consistency, but it's as good of a launch point of this particular story and this particular season as Breaking Bad. Now,
yeah,
does it have the ceiling of Breaking Bad? That's an interesting question.
It's an entirely different question.
Because as good as you might say that Frasier was, I don't think anyone argues that it's better than Cheers. I certainly would never argue that. You're probably too young for both of them.
I've never seen either of those. Like, legitimately sat down and watched them. Right. I've seen one-offs of several of them.
Right.
I think Eric, the personal arrogance host, Eric, is an exception to that. I think he likes
if you live in
Frasier,
Seattle, sure.
Because he lives in Seattle, and that was closer to his generation.
Yeah, like, I love Parks and Rec, not only because it's excellent, but because it's set in Indiana, and
the visceral
thrill of seeing small-town Indiana life,
sure,
you know, parodied and kind of, you know, in an affectionate way. So, yeah, talked a lot about that. I just don't know what the ceiling for Breaking Bad is. And that's not bad. Like, you know, just like Frasier is not a terrible show. It just wasn't as good and groundbreaking and as good a comedy, as perfect and crafted a comedy as Cheers was. Bear from the UK said, "We were all perplexed, or as I like to say, aplexed, when the early preseason reviews claimed that Better Call Saul is better than Breaking Bad. But now we've seen the show to be excellent, and I think we all have to genuinely discuss if it is in the same league. We kind of started it already. My question's for you. One, if you treat this as Breaking Bad sequel and look at it as a pure fan of the Breaking Bad universe, was this better than season one of Breaking Bad?"
My answer is no.
Breaking Bad season two or season three? No. Well,
I think there were more fundamentally interesting things in season one of Breaking Bad. Like, a man who has cancer, not long to live, has a family to provide for and decides to turn to a life of crime for that is a fundamentally more interesting hook to me personally.
Yeah, knowing where, yeah. I think season two is a more interesting comparison because I do think there is a huge flaw in season two, and it's a structural fundamental problem. It's not like a pacing issue. But I can make an argument, but I couldn't really say that with a straight face. Season two of Breaking Bad is pretty phenomenal.
All the way up
to the payoff of the black and white pink teddy bear scenes.
Let me say this for Better Call Saul.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Better Call Saul, in a good way, takes a little more time to unfold its story and its premise. With Breaking Bad is... the whole plot is thrust down your throat immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Man with cancer, man with family, turns to life of crime. And then
a lot of miles are covered in the first goddamn episode.
They are. And then the subsequent episodes in that season become what are the antics that he gets up to as he gets deeper into this life of crime.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I think in Better Call Saul, it builds a little more slowly. Hmm. It lets the frog boil in the water a little bit longer. Until you get to episode 9, and then you discover what this show is really about.
I do think that Better Call Saul feels a bit more confident.
I think so too.
That makes sense. You know,
yeah.
Vince Gilligan did have a writer's strike that he's staring down. He did have to cut the season. He didn't know whether there would be a ratings phenomenon or any kind of success.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much all through the first three seasons of Breaking Bad, whereas Better Call Saul, I think, Yeah, he didn't know what it was going to, but I suspect that he and Gould thought, like, you know, if we do a good job on this, we're going to find an audience.
Yes, it would be hard not to.
Yeah,
given Breaking Bad's
success. I'm sure they were nervous, but I didn't get much in the way of nerves from them at preseason. Or maybe it's because they're both rich and successful, and there's nothing at this
it
point.
Doesn't really matter. The stakes are lower.
You know, it's like every time he thinks, like, oh, what if I fuck this up? He goes and looks at M. Night Shyamalan's career, and like, nah, I'll get at least six or seven other foul balls and strikeouts before I'm out of work in Hollywood.
So that is all to say. I think season one of both of these shows is different, although I enjoy Breaking Bad slightly more.
Point two from Barry from the UK. If you look at this as someone who has never seen Breaking Bad, does it still hold up? And I want to stop there because we have some emails, coincidentally, to answer that very question.
Okay.
And three, how compelling a character and actor is Jimmy/Bob Odenkirk compared to Walter White? And he says, I don't know the answers, but my feeling is they're in the same ballpark, and these early reviews now hold a lot of weight. I think it's interesting that those early reviews were based on some of the weaker material, and I think there was a little bit of overheating on that stuff, but Jimmy, better than Walter White, Bob Odenkirk, better than Bryan Cranston.
How about they're both incredible at what they do, which is very different.
And how about the fact that you can say they're in the same ballpark is nothing I would have suspected before the season.
Yeah.
Like I knew Bob could do Saul really, really well. I did not suspect some of the stuff he pulls off in Pimento.
Honestly, I didn't know
Jonathan Banks could pull off what we saw in 5-0.
Yeah, that's true. He didn't have what looked like a ton of range in Breaking Bad. But I still give the nod to Bryan Cranston. We've seen a lot more from him, right?
He's been given the material that, like,
exactly.
Better Call Saul can't even sniff yet.
Yeah. And I mean, if I were to put Bryan Cranston, you know, in my imagination into the scenes that Bob Odenkirk got in this first season, I don't think he's as funny, but I think he's better on the drama end. Slightly.
Hard to say, because, man, Bryan Cranston can be funny.
He can be.
In a different way.
It is in a different way. It's not the sleazy kind of way. It's more the silly, more irreverent sort of way.
Yeah, because even when he played that, like, Pawn Stars parody for, like, the Oscars or the Emmys, it was a very much tongue-in-cheek parody of that.
Oh, yeah.
So,
But Bob Odenkirk brings a lot of the same drama qualities, but his comedy is just spot on, because that is what he does.
Sure. Yeah.
And he's great at it.
And I think that's another thing I got from the interviews, is that the last two episodes were way different than they envisioned it, because when they saw what Bob could do, they're like, well, hell, we need to turn up the heat. So I will say that it's a huge compliment to say that we can have this conversation with a straight face.
Yeah.
Because there's another universe where I could be like, this is a great show, but just calm the fuck down. Calm the fuck down.
Just have it be a comedy and let's move on. Yeah,
but the fact that
this experiment went wrong a long time ago.
But the fact that we're having this conversation is kind of impressive, honestly.
Definitely.
So Jesse Y goes into answering the second question here. I've been watching Better Call Saul with my husband, who has only seen season one of Breaking Bad and thus has no introduction to Saul or Mike. He loves the show, and the Villa Gang has done such a great job of fleshing out the characters without relying on knowledge of their futures that he rarely has questions for me. He doesn't yell out Tuco when he first appears, but we're both excited to see Nacho from another great show y'all should watch, Orphan Black. We both got a kick out of the Saul Goodman early on, and his favorite character is Mike, as is mine. Mike's badassery came as more of a surprise to him, though of course I tried to explain a little during the first few Toll Booth episodes. But I think it made it more fun not knowing just how awesome he would become. I think Better Call Saul is more approachable for people who don't like the tone, if that's even the right word, of Breaking Bad. We binge-watched the first season together on Netflix, and I think right before season 3 started, but we were just so depressed after every episode that we decided to not go to season 2 immediately, and that turned into never. Better Call Saul definitely had more humor, and for some people, it's just more fun to watch if you don't want your heart in your throat the whole time. Parenthetically, she says, we have Americans for that. A show that I tapped out on. So, different strokes for different folks.
I get it. I mean, that description makes sense.
Jesse says, I think I cut out a part where she says that she the start of season five, did manage to go through sans her husband and finish Breaking Bad. Ah. She goes, I don't think it's at the level of Breaking Bad yet, but I don't think that's a prerequisite for enjoying the show. Hear, hear.
You're right.
Hear, hear. Clayton from Battle Creek, Michigan. I've never watched a single episode of Breaking Bad, but I've been with Better Call Saul for the whole series. I've always wanted to get into Breaking Bad, but I just can't seem to find the time. I love everything about the series, and all it does is make me want to watch Breaking Bad even more. Well, that's a great mission objective for this show.
It's making me wonder what Breaking Bad looks like as a second show to Better Call Saul. Like, we kind of discussed, you know, does Better Call Saul work without having seen Breaking Bad, but does Breaking Bad work after having seen Better Call Saul
is going to be interesting. The eternal debate about whether if you wanted to acknowledge the prequel trilogy at all, if you're like, you know, in the shoes I'm in, you got an impressionable young adult or young person, do you show them the original trilogy first? Do you show them prequel trilogy, then original trilogy? Do you
do you never show them the prequels?
Do you do the controversial 1, 4, 5, 2, 3, 6? Mm-hmm. So it's basically an extended flashback. Do you pretend they don't exist? Like, I don't think that's an option because this thing doesn't suck. But yeah, that I like those kind of debates.
I don't think we'll know until the run of Better Call Saul is over, but it's an interesting question.
I like having those kind of, I like debating that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's fun. He continues, I love everything about this series. And I already said that. There's so many good things. I've heard so many good things about Breaking Bad, and I figured I should get in on the ground floor of this series. It's kind of nice to see the backstories of these characters without knowing what they become. I didn't think that Mike disassembling the gun in the Pimento episode was unrealistic at all for someone who used to be a police officer and maybe even had more military in his background. Yes, he has a dexterity of steel, so to speak, but if you're familiar with the gun, it's not overly inconceivable that would work. I didn't have a problem with him field stripping the gun, Batman it's style.
How fast he swipes it.
And just the fact that he would, you know, this old guy could go up to these guys and completely intimidate them. I question whether that would be believable without
as a non,
because it's not like Mike viewer. Kicks in a door and like, oh my God, what a badass he is.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, here's a guy who has never seen the series and he didn't have a problem with it. It's hard to argue with that.
Yeah.
That's the last email. And this is why I feel like we don't need a wrap up. Felt like a really good series wrap up.
I think so. I've talked about basically everything that I would care to talk about going forward. I think they've set it up super nicely for season two. I think there's a lot of tension there.
Yes.
That there's a lot of promise if you look at Jimmy turning into Saul as a promise. A lot still to come, a lot of stuff with Mike that I think we're going to get to eventually that seems both fun and interesting.
And please do continue to send in your thoughts and predictions for next season to Better Cast Saul while they're fresh in your mind, because what Better Cast Saul at baldmove.com. Because what I like to do when I'm doing a preview cast, which I'm morally certain we will do for Better Call Saul, is like I go back, I put a filter on and go back all the way and like get interesting nuggets from the previous, so we can, you know, because it's always hard coming out the preview when you haven't seen the thing for 8 months, and having that people's fresh thoughts on it is really makes for an interesting preview. So no new podcast until next season, but don't feel shy about sending that stuff and talking about in the forums, because we'll still be probably debating some of these things. I imagine this will be kind of a lively topic in the forums about, you know, where it ranks against.
I think so. Yeah.
Breaking Bad.
I'm sure I probably haven't said the last I want to say about it. And I'm certain our audience hasn't. So
yeah,
the forums are a great place to go talk about that.
I mean, it's at forums.baldmove.com. And if you are depressed that Better Call Saul is over and you're looking for something to occupy your time, we've got a lot of great content. We've come up this is the most content we pushed out in a given time frame, like any 2 months. I think it's a world record.
It has been certainly our busiest season.
We had the last of The Walking Dead season 5. We had Justified season 6 that's wrapping up. We just got done Better Call Saul. We got House of Cards in there. A few episodes of The Americans. We're starting Mad Men, Game of Thrones, which are monsters. We're going to be starting getting back on our commissioned podcast. Lots of stuff going on at Bald Move. Later on in the year, there's going to be a lot of other cool stuff. If you like this kind of quality drama that we'll be covering, the best way to stay in touch with all that is You know, check us out on baldmove.com. Specifically, you can follow, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/baldmove. Follow Jim on Twitter at baldmove, because the handy thing is it's automatic. As soon as we post an article, it gets copied out through that. So you'll see, you can kind of like keep your finger on the pulse of what we're doing. I'm sure something we do will be interesting to you.
Yeah, we cover a lot of movies in the off season. Those commission casts are almost exclusively movies.
Seems like it.
And pretty big ones too. Ones that you've almost certainly seen.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to that stuff. Yeah, that's it. Thanks everybody for sticking with us through this season. The other thing I guess you could do if you really want to get in the spirit is go leave us an iTunes review. Bump us up there one last time.
That would be nice.
Maybe give some of your fellow fans a little opportunity to see us on the charts there.
Yeah, get us prime for next season too.
Yeah, that's super easy to do. Takes a few seconds. Really helps us out. So that's it. And that's it. Well, I don't want to let go of the Better Call Saul podcast, but got
to
be done.
It's time to leave the troll booth.
All right.
Hopefully with our parking paid.
I've got all the stamps, so we're good. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next year. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.